The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Happy Wednesday! Yes, we've made it to Wednesday. It's only day two in my week, and I'm already just exhausted because there's so much going on. You know, yesterday, on Monday, the White House press briefing session was held by Raj Shah, the deputy White House press secretary. And apparently he screwed up so badly that they canceled yesterday's in its entirety. But Seth Meyers decided to do a public service and give us a White House press briefing in which they actually answer the questions. So since we could use a bit of a giggle to start the show, I thought we would do that, and then we'll get on to the serious stuff, okay? All right.
It is time for late night White House press briefing. Sarah, yeah, over here. Sarah, yeah, thank you. Seth Meyers, Late Night with Seth Meyers. Secretary Sanders, how do you think the history books will remember the Trump presidency?
Nothing more than a poorly executed PR stunt.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, why does the president keep attacking Robert Mueller on Twitter?
The president does not have a lot of respect for people whose sole job is to carry out the law.
Ooh.
If you could only name one, what's the biggest weakness of the Trump administration?
Certainly our intelligence.
Yeah. Or lack thereof.
What's Don Jr.'s primary role in the White House?
Collusion with Russia.
Oh, that played out today.
What do you think the future of this country looks like?
I don't know that there will be one by the end of this year.
Oh, me either. That's sad.
When I look into your eyes, I sense a deep sadness. Why?
I spend more time with the president than anyone else.
Makes sense.
One last question. Do you think President Trump is through with porn stars?
I'm sure he'd be happy to do a few more.
Well, it looks like we're out of time. So
sure he would.
All
right. Thank you very much, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow. Yes, this Seth Meyers getting a little bit of honesty out of Sarah Sanders for a change. I don't know if she did one today or not. I honestly was so busy trying to pour through all the news that's happened today since I recorded What's News this morning. And what we'll do is I'll give you a rundown of some of the stuff that's happened because I can't wrap my brain around it all. There's just too much going on. It's one of those days that, yes.
The heads would spin. Yeah. Your head will spin.
Your head will spin.
Your head will spin.
And my head is spinning. There's too much going on. I do want to let you know that our guest today is an old friend who returns, Harvey J.K., a professor and author. He's got some exciting news to share with us surrounding his most recent book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms. And I figured, look, you know, the Four Freedoms was all about FDR when there was still hope for this nation. And I figured this is a time when we could all use some of that hope. And remember that there was a time when the country was in worse peril than it's in now. Right? The Great Depression pretty much sucked, to put it lightly. And FDR pulled us out of it. So there is hope yet. And so maybe if we take us back to that time and realize the ideals that got us there, it'll help our collective psyche a little bit. All right. So first, let me fill you in on some of the things that happened since I recorded What's News this morning. Tens of thousands of public school teachers in North Carolina are rallying at the state capitol today in the latest teacher walkout following West Virginia, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Arizona, and Colorado. And as their colleagues in other states have done, they're not only fighting for more money for themselves, they're fighting for more funding for their classrooms. I read a piece today that in at least one school, they were having to decide between paying the electric bill or purchasing toilet paper. Let that sink in for a second. Paying the electric bill or purchasing toilet paper. And this is why teachers on their paltry salaries are having to dip into their pockets and buy supplies. When I would hear supplies, I was thinking, all right, they're bringing in crayons and markers and, you know, things like that. No, I mean toilet paper. It's a shame. And I know, you know, my kid just finished school last year. But every year, you know, she'd come home with the things that she needed for her class. And then there were always paper towels and, hand sanitizer and, dry, erase board markers and things like that. And I'm thinking, you know, these are not supplies she needs. These are supplies the classroom needs. And I came to the realization that, yeah, the teachers needed them. And if the kids didn't bring them in and donate them to the classrooms, the teachers in most cases had to reach into their own pocketbooks and do it themselves. So, to those teachers in North Carolina and around the country, more power to you. You know, it was so important that we give these giant corporations huge tax breaks, but teachers are just fighting to stay alive. Some working 2, 3, and 4 jobs just to stay afloat. It's criminal. It really is criminal. In other news, Trump released his financial disclosure report. CNN is reporting that he disclosed 2016 expenses incurred by Michael Cohen and said he fully reimbursed him in 2017. The report says the value was between $100,001 and $250,000. But that already goes against some other reports that say that the payouts were more along the lines of closer to $500,000. Stay tuned on this one. I think there's more coming. The Senate Intelligence Committee says the U.S. intelligence community was correct in assessing that Russia interfered in the 2016 U.S. elections with the aim of helping Donald Trump, contradicting findings House Republicans reached last month when they prematurely closed out their investigation. I don't know where this goes, but that's from the Senate Intelligence Committee. More to come on that one as well. Okay. This is the big news that I haven't really had time to go through, but the Senate today released thousands of pages of documents related to testimony about that infamous June 2016 Trump Tower meeting with John Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, those guys all meeting with Russian officials who promised them dirt on Hillary Clinton. I can't quite remember from Don Jr. Boy, it's amazing how people, their memories fade when they're speaking. He wasn't even under oath, because it was an interview, not an interrogation, but it is a lie. It is a lie. It is a crime to lie to Congress. It is a crime to lie to the FBI. So even if you're not under oath, you still sort of are, you know, like for me, it's my word. I don't care if I put my hand on the Bible or not. I don't believe in the Bible. If you take an oath, you say you're not going to lie. You don't lie. and it's crime if you do. So I'm sure as all the news organizations go through those thousands of pages of testimony, a lot more will come out. Stay tuned. Tomorrow, we'll deal with yesterday's primaries more at length when Howie Klein is on. But Democrats or progressives, I should say, won a big victory in Omaha, Nebraska when Kara Eastman beat her blue dog opponent, former Congressman Brad Ashford. Howie spoke about this last Thursday. The DCCC was pushing this Brad Ashford guy really hard. He's a former congressman who was a blue dog who lost his last bid, and they recruited him again. And up comes Kara Eastman, she works for a nonprofit, a first-time candidate, a true progressive who believes in single payer and other things that real progressives believe in, and she beat him. And I saw a tweet from Howie Klein earlier today where he said the DCCC dropped Brad Ashford from their red to blue page but didn't replace him with Kara Eastman. There's really something wrong with them. It's like they're shooting themselves in the foot. It is that Democratic Party that knows how to defeat that knows how to pull a defeat from the jaws of victory. It's stunning to me. And on the topic of net neutrality, the Senate just voted 52-47 on the bill to restore net neutrality and to protect the open internet. I think there's going to be another vote. I'm not quite sure of the mechanics of it, but here's the problem. It's great that the Senate came through, did what they needed to do. The problem is the House likely won't even put it up for a vote. And even if they did, and even on the off chance that it would pass, it would still go to Donald Trump. So, again, people, our choice in the matter is to, is to vote. To vote in your primary whenever it comes up, and then to vote in November and let the Democrats take back the House and please take back the Senate. And then we can start, pushing back on the evils that the Trump administration is pushing upon us. Until then, we're powerless. We're just powerless. And I'm all with Howie on getting progressives elected. Where I differ from Howie is when it comes down to the general. At this point, with our lives at stake, the four freedoms that we're going to talk with Harvey J.K. about, it's more important than ever that we elect Democrats, even if they be of the blue dog variety. Although, take advantage of the primary season to vote in the good guys to get to get progressives in office like Kara Eastman. It shows that if we build it, they will come. You put out a real progressive in Omaha, Nebraska, and real progressives will come out and vote for her. All right. We'll check in with What's News and come back with Harvey J.K. And the fight for the four freedoms, a fight that's more important now than it ever has been.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
A June 12th meeting in Singapore between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un was thrown into limbo on Wednesday after North Korea denounced military exercises between South Korea and the United States as a provocation and called off high-level talks with Seoul. The North Korean Central News Agency said the drills between the South Korean and U.S. Air Forces are a rehearsal for an invasion of the North. Reuters is reporting that North Korean officials say the country will rethink the U.S. summit if pressured to abandon the nuclear program. MSNBC's Brian Williams has more.
Do you deserve the Nobel Prize, do you think?
Everyone thinks so, but I would never say it. You know what I want to do? I want to get it finished. The prize I want is victory for the world, not for even here. I want victory for the world, because that's what we're talking about. So that's the only prize I want.
We're seeing the dangers tonight of getting out ahead of a summit with a volatile adversary. Just a short time ago, you may have seen the breaking news graphic at the bottom of our screen. The Reuters news agency reported, quote, North Korea said it may reconsider holding a summit with the United States if Washington continues to unilaterally insist on North Korea giving up its nuclear program, the North State media said on Wednesday. North Korea's central news agency, Is There Any Other, also said the fate of the U.S.-North Korea summit, as well as bilateral relations, would be clear if Washington speaks of a Libya-style denuclearization for the North. The statement added U.S. President Donald Trump would remain as a failed president if he follows in the steps of his predecessors. This comes just hours after North Korea pulled out of its high-level talks with the South and made an earlier threat to that June 12th summit. They're apparently angered by the ongoing, long-scheduled, by the way, joint U.S.-South Korean military drills. Pentagon released a statement today saying the exercises are defensive in nature and part of a routine annual training program. Earlier today, State Department said preparations for the summit are still underway, and the North has not notified the U.S. of any official change.
The protests in Israel continue as hundreds of people marched through Tel Aviv Tuesday to protest Israeli troops firing on Palestinian protesters in Gaza, killing 60 people. The U.S. blocked the adoption of a U.N. Security Council resolution calling for a probe into the violence that broke out on the Gaza border, while the Palestinians recalled their envoy from Washington to protest the move of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. On Tuesday, Senators Mark Warner, Heidi Heitkamp, and Bill Nelson announced they'd support Gina Haspel in her bid to be the next director of the CIA, clearing the path for her nomination. Haspel had to overcome questions about her involvement with the torture program in the years after 9/11. The confirmation vote could come as early as this week. The U.S. Senate will vote on Wednesday on whether to reverse a decision by the Trump administration to roll back Obama-era net neutrality rules. Advocates of keeping the 2015 open internet rules have the backing of 50 U.S. senators, including Republican Susan Collins. And with the absence of Senator John McCain because of illness, they believe they will win on a 50-49 vote. However, the effort still faces an uphill battle. It's unlikely that the Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives will even vote on the issue. And, of course, the White House backs the FCC rules approved last December. The White House has eliminated the position of cyber czar less than 2 years after the U.S. fell prey to a massive cyber attack from Russia. Go figure. Ahead of high-level trade talks between the U.S. and China, the Washington Post obtained a list of demands which shed some more light on the ZTE deal. CNN has more.
We're hearing that the White House was also caught off guard.
They were indeed. The White House was surprised by these news reports. I am told by a senior administration official the president was made aware of them, but from news reports, not from any official sources. So buildings across Washington, here at the White House, the State Department, and indeed the Pentagon, were taken by surprise by this. But Jake, this is all coming as an interesting meeting scheduled to take place 1 week from today. President Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, is scheduled to be here at the White House to talk to President about that South Korea summit and the North Korean summit in Singapore next month. So all of this certainly is coming up in the air. But, Jake, we remember very well when the president 2 months ago first agreed to the beginning talks of these meetings. He said that the North had agreed to leave discussions about the military exercises to not stop them from happening. So that has always been on the table here. But, Jake, this is one thing that senior administration officials, some of them, have quietly worried and wondered about. What could North Korea do to potentially disrupt this summit? Is President Trump acting too eager for this summit to happen here? Has he removed leverage from these discussions? As all of this is still being coming in and sorted through, I'm told by an administration official, look for some other type of reaction, possibly from the White House, once they sort of get a handle on what's going on.
And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener funded, and I really can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
We're very grateful for Scott Pruitt's leadership. And I would just tell you that
EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt still has a job amid revelations EPA blocked reports showing widespread water contamination. New studies confirm global warming is rapidly intensifying hurricanes and their rainfall. Plus, California adopts landmark new solar building codes.
All of that tyranny and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Today is the 50th birthday of EPA chief and endangered animal fracker Scott Pruitt. Personally, I'll be honoring Scotty by roasting polar bear kebabs over a plastic bottle bonfire.
Happy birthday, Scott Pruitt. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, we go away for a week, which is like 3 years in Donald Trump time, and Scott Pruitt still has a job at the EPA?
Yes, yes, he does.
The most corrupt EPA administrator of all time?
Yep, but we'll get to that in a moment. First, Trump administration aides blocked the publication of a major federal health study showing a widespread nationwide water contamination crisis. That's just one of the revelations in a trove of internal Environmental Protection Agency emails obtained via public information requests by the Union of Concerned Scientists. The emails show that federal scientists with the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry had determined that toxic chemicals known as PFOA and PFOS, used in Teflon and other products, have contaminated water supplies across the country and pose a much greater danger to human health at far lower contamination levels than the EPA had previously said was safe.
So we know what's in this report. It looks bad for a whole bunch of companies, and yet the administration is simply refusing to release it?
That's right. The study was blocked after EPA political appointees and White House appointees called the revelations, quote, a potential public relations nightmare, saying that publication would increase the cost of cleanups of contamination at military sites and chemical manufacturing plants.
We know Scott Pruitt and Donald Trump are climate change deniers, but they have pretended the one thing they do care about is clean air and clean water, and here we see they don't actually care about clean water at all.
No, they apparently do not. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt still has his job and is still deregulating those industries that pollute Americans' air and water. In an interview with NBC, Vice President Mike Pence ignored questions about Pruitt's spending and his corruption scandals and instead praised Pruitt for foisting the burden of pollution onto the public.
Scott Pruitt has done an outstanding job lifting the burden of regulations that were stifling American businesses across this country.
Never mind the people who live at those contaminated sites who don't even know that they're drinking contaminated water. Meanwhile, forecasters now say the U.S. should brace for another active Atlantic hurricane season this year, which officially begins on June 1st, even as hard-hit communities like Puerto Rico are still struggling from last year's hurricanes. Now, a new study from the U.S. Pacific Northwest National Laboratory confirms that powerful Atlantic hurricane storms, fueled by warming ocean temperatures, are intensifying much more rapidly than they did just 30 years ago, spinning up from zero to extremely dangerous in just hours and giving communities little time to prepare. A separate study also concludes that warmer oceans are turbocharging storms' rainfall capacity, turning them into even greater rain producers. And just a reminder, hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria last year each landed among the top five costliest hurricanes in U.S. history. In Louisiana, electric utility giant Entergy has confirmed that its PR company paid actors as much as $200 a day to pose as grassroots supporters testifying in support of their controversial proposed natural gas power plant in front of the New Orleans City Council. Entergy claims it did not know about the use of paid actors in advance, but has announced it will not charge customers for that cost.
Wow. So they were paying actual crisis actors to show up and do this.
Yes, they were.
No wonder Republicans think the Democrats are being paid to protest by George Soros, because that's what they're doing all the time, actually paying people to protest.
Finally, some good news. In a landmark revision of statewide building codes, the California Energy Commission voted unanimously to require rooftop solar panels to be installed on all new single-family homes and multifamily buildings in the state beginning in 2020. The updated building codes also add incentives for advanced energy efficiency and were supported by the home building industry. A state study found that the higher upfront cost of energy-efficient homes with rooftop solar would be more than offset by cheaper utility bills.
Well, there's some good news. Thank you, Des. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
Well, where is he?
Where is who?
Where is Harvey?
Oh, you mean Harvey J.K.
Yeah, Harvey.
Well, he's coming up right now on The Nicole Sandler Show.
It's been a while, but he's back. Harvey J.K. is the director of the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay's Center for History and Social Change and professor of Democracy and Justice Studies. He's published 10 books on history and politics, including his most recent, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. So with our freedoms eroding in the age of Trump, we figured it was time to remember them. But we're not the only ones who think that way. Hey, Harvey.
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear me okay? I'm trying something out here.
Yeah, I hear you fine.
That's great. All I can tell you is, you know, we have this really expensive headset that always gives us problems when I talk to you. And then I tried just the earbuds that come with the iPhone, and they seem to be the better thing. So, here we go.
It works. So you're doing something really cool based around the four freedoms. But before we get into that, for people who don't know, and I would think most of the people who listen to this show know about FDR and the four freedoms, but, you know, there are some who probably don't. So what are the four freedoms?
Okay, well, and I'm glad you asked, because they might know of the four freedoms, but they may not have the full picture, and I'll try to present that. In January 1941, Roosevelt gave a State of the Union address in which this was the first State of the Union address after he won a third term as president, an unprecedented third term as president in November of 1940. And in this speech, he had a variety of ambitions. The most fundamental was to tell Americans that they were threatened, that the war in Europe and the war in East Asia that we come to know as World War II, that we would not be immune to this, that the dictators had us in their sights. And so his first ambition was basically to tell Americans it was time to get ready. In a way, the Four Freedoms speech, although it's a vision of the world beyond a war, is pretty much a call to arms, especially with the idea that the United States should become the arsenal of democracy. And in order not to, I mean, he clearly wanted to rally Americans, but he also wanted to reassure them that the possibility of our going to war did not mean an end to the campaigns we know of as the New Deal to not only get us out of the Depression, but to empower Americans in a more democratic way, whether it had to do with making sure they had jobs, making sure that the elderly had Social Security, and those who were in any way disabled would have Social Security, enabling workers to organize by putting the government behind their efforts. I mean, this was to assure them that the war itself would not bring an end to Americans' aspirations to advance freedom, equality, and democracy at home. And late in the speech, he says to Americans that we should look forward to a world based on four fundamental freedoms. And the four freedoms specifically were freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, and those in many ways sort of resonate or come out of the First Amendment to the Bill of the Bill of Rights of the mm-hmm. Constitution. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to two further propositions, which are very much at the heart of American life, but I don't think anyone had articulated them as something that we should recognize as a fundamental freedom for Americans and others around the world. And those were freedom from want and freedom from fear. You know, if you have a moment, I'll just read his words, because I want to make a point about this, okay?
Okay.
He said, in the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way, everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. And finally, the fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world. Hmm. And I just want to say, I'm sure everyone noticed his addition to each of those sentences of everywhere in the world and anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to know that he actually meant that in the sense that he envisioned the United Nations. He believed that a United Nations would be a fundamental means by which we would establish world peace, world security, and at least a reasonable level of decency, standard of living for everyone. And by the way, when he ran for vice president in 1920 on the Democratic ticket, he and his senior running mate, the man running for president, were running on a campaign that include a platform that included the League of Nations, that the United States should enter. One of the reasons they lost in 1920 is the Republicans really made a case that the League of Nations would threaten American sovereignty. But he still had in his head that the only way to secure world peace was probably through United Nations. Now, but here's the other thing. When he said everywhere in the world, surveys that were done afterward and people imagined that by saying what he did, that it would put people off the idea of the four freedoms. You mean to say we're going to have to go to war to provide security and peace and a decent standard of living for everyone in the world? But in fact, most Americans didn't respond negatively to it. They responded positively to the speech, because when they heard each of those four freedoms, they understood them in very American terms. And for example, freedom of speech and expression was clearly something that labor union people and working people wanted, because as far as they were concerned, it meant that there would be an advance of industrial democracy in the workplace, that workers would continue to organize and would have a much greater say in the workplace. Freedom of worship was not merely the idea you could go into the church of your choice or not even go into church. It was also the idea that if you were not in a community of the majority faith, say in the South, Southern Baptists, whether you were Jewish or Catholic or anything else, that you would be safe being who you were, whether you were in church or outside walking or practicing your profession or pursuing your business. And that was of particular concern in that sense that I'm saying it to Jews and Catholics, because Catholics did have a hard time in the South, and Jews had a very hard time, even more so in some ways in the North, where Jewish elderly folks were being attacked on the streets of Boston and Brooklyn by Irish Catholic thugs who were inspired by someone people may or may not have heard of, Father Coughlin, who was pretty much a pro-Hitler fascist Catholic priest. So it mattered to people. And when they heard those lines, it mattered a great deal. Moreover, African Americans heard freedom of speech and expression as if it was a promise that they would secure civil rights and the right to vote, that would be coming. Then when we moved to freedom from want and freedom from fear, I mean, this was 10 years or so into the Depression, though the war effort had already been lifting us out of the Depression in a way that even the New Deal had not. But when Americans heard freedom from want and freedom from fear, they actually believed that there were going to be serious initiatives to lift them not only out of poverty, but also to assure them a decent life. So, for example, as we can come back to later, people mm-hmm. believed that Social Security might come to include national health care.
Yep.
So freedom from want was not just we'll have food, clothing, and shelter, but which, by the way, would have been a great advance for a lot of people at many times, but also that it would go on to include such things as national health care, and also a guarantee of some kind of educational opportunity. And then freedom from fear. This is a really powerful one. And I think whenever I've talked about this, there are a lot of people say freedom from fear. Wasn't that promising too much, right? You know, isn't fear a good thing in some ways? It's a motivator. And I thought to myself, give me a break, you know? Well, yeah, so what this meant to African-Americans in the South when they heard this was a promise that they would no longer have to worry about such groups as the Klan and attacking them.
Right.
You know, Catholics no longer watching crosses burn on lawns. Jews, as I said before. The idea was that the four freedoms did matter to Americans. And so Roosevelt really, really hit it right. And we can come back later to his later speech, the Second Bill of Rights. But this became pretty much the guiding theme of the war effort. And many sins were committed in the course of that war. I mean, there was a Japanese-American internment. There had been not enough effort to provide a refuge for Jews escaping Central European fascism. And also in the course of the war, in the U.S. Army and other services, African Americans suffered a Jim Crow military. They were separated out into separate units. And so you can imagine that every time I've given this talk to people, well, what about this and what about that? And I always say to them, absolutely. But the most fascinating thing about that experience is that all of those Americans, both those who had a great deal to defend, but also those who might have had less to defend because of the way they might have been oppressed or exploited, they threw themselves into the war effort in some ways even more than anyone else because they believed that the four freedoms were theirs and that the war effort would enable them to begin to secure the things that Roosevelt spoke of. So there you go.
Harvey J.K. is with us. So there's the intro to what the four freedoms were. The sad part is here we are in 2018, and we're still fighting for those same four freedoms. There have been sort of peaks and valleys throughout history where we had access, I think, to some of them. But
yeah, no, absolutely, Nicole. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, those who were in the labor movement who believed that freedom of speech and expression would necessarily enhance workers' rights in the workplace, and they did.
Mm-hmm.
They did all the way through into the 1970s. But you and I know well, and anyone else, you know, anyone else who pays attention, and I'm sure every one of your listeners does, the fact is that for 40 years now, we've seen a class war on labor that has not only demolished the labor movement. I belong to two labor unions, and I intend to stay there. But it is the case that unions have been smashed over these past 40 years, and workers' rights in the workplace are truly under siege. And we could go on to other rights under siege, African Americans' right to vote, women's right to control their own bodies. These have been under siege for 40 years now. So freedom of speech, undeniably. Now, freedom of worship, I don't think there's any question that for most people, freedom of worship has become standard operating procedure. I don't think most people are anxious about it, unless you're a Muslim.
Yep.
Okay.
And these days, absolutely.
In this past year, you and I are. I mean, I was horrified. I don't think I've recovered yet from the events in Charlottesville.
That's right.
Right. So even freedom of worship in this country, freedom to be who you are, freedom of conscience is under assault. And by the way, as we well know, these folks were brought out by a man who won the presidency. He lost the popular vote, but nevertheless, he won the presidency. And this is probably the ugliest set of moments in American history in my lifetime, even uglier than the late 60s and to the early 70s.
Wow. That's saying a lot because
freedom for what? I mean, you and I know that, you know, they tried to destroy Obamacare, which with all its faults, at least provided the promise eventually of securing national health care. You know that they're salivating the Republicans. You can almost imagine that the reason they do nothing to push out Trump, nothing at all, is because they're still salivating at the prospect of privatizing Social Security.
Yeah, they still want look. They just they're regrouping again to kill off what's left of Obamacare.
Yeah. Every day you turn it off. Well, it's like a mad race, right? Mueller versus you know what? So.
Yeah,
and freedom from fear. I mean, basically speaking, I mean, Trump pursues overseas adventures in spite of the fact he said we're going to become a little more sane in our foreign policy. It often seems like we've become terribly insane. First, he's threatening war with North Korea, then he's breaking the Iran treaty, and, you know, on and on and on.
Yeah, it's the opposite of anything known as sanity. Hey, Harvey, a question from the chat room. The Dormouse is asking, please ask Harvey J.K. how FDR and progressive Dems of the 1930s were able to get the racist reactionary Southern Dems to cooperate enough for the Dems as a party to still beat the Republicans.
Well, that's a really good question. So let's put it into context. The first thing to understand is that the Democrats were the, if you like, the one party in the South, as people out there may know, during the 1930s. Republicans didn't stand a chance. But this both advantaged Roosevelt in securing him the Electoral College votes in the South, but it also disadvantaged him in a particular way. And here's why. Southern Democrats, you know, who would later become known as the Dixiecrats, they really were powerful in the Senate because, as we know, congressional committees, the Senate included, are chaired by people with the most seniority in the governing party. So the Southern Democrats dominated the committees that would literally enact, push through, and oversee what we think of as the New Deal. Now, fortunately, the South was so poor that the Southern Democrats were eager to get federal dollars. But there was a limit to how eager they were to get them. And here's the thing. They did not want federal dollars to empower African Americans. They really wanted to hold on to white supremacy and Jim Crow. Hmm. So it meant when key legislative initiatives that Roosevelt was pushing, such as Social Security and the National Labor Relations Act, when these came through Congress, the Southern Democrats could not change the law to be explicitly racist, because the 14th Amendment basically, you know, you could not discriminate, at a federal level based on race. Separation by way of Plessy versus Ferguson was okay, but you were not allowed specifically to discriminate, although in practice we know full well what discrimination was. Mm-hmm. So what they did is they discriminated in those laws based on occupation. So in the Social Security Act, there were two categories of workers who were left out of the Social Security Act. Federal workers were too, but that's another story. They got their own pension system. The two categories were agricultural workers. So that meant those who worked on the big land holdings in the South. It also, by the way, advantaged Southwestern landholders who were exploiting Mexican-American labor. Hmm. And the other category was household labor, which of course meant African-American maids in Southern households. And also, strangely enough, I always wondered how it affected Irish-American maids in Northern households, but the Southern Democrats weren't concerned about them as much as they were keeping blacks from gaining access to the advantages of Social Security. And then in the National Labor Relations Act, they did the same thing. They extended the National Labor Relations Act to everything but agricultural workers and, of course, certain kinds of other domestic workers. So they were able to, Roosevelt and the progressives were able to get through the major initiatives by way of having to bow, if you like, to these Southern Democrats on certain things. But Roosevelt's expectation was, and this comes back in the speech that I was going to go back to eventually if we have a chance, or we can talk about it some other time as well, he actually proposed national health care.
Right.
As a right, specifically as a right in 1944, and later Truman did too. But those Southern Democrats, I mean, they were just SOBs. I mean, they were willing to literally keep their own folks, the white folks, from getting health care in order to make sure blacks didn't get access to white hospitals.
Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. You bet. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that the Four Freedoms really took hold as a – I hope I answered Dormouse's question. If not, you know, don't hesitate to pry further. Okay, push me further. But I was going to say, so the Four Freedoms really became the sort of dominant idea of the war effort. And there were certain movies addressed it, artworks addressed it, the most famous being the project involving the project I'm on now, to put the Four Freedoms paintings by Norman Rockwell back on the road, because this is the 75th anniversary of the 1943 War Bonds Drive, the national effort to raise monies to enhance the war, to enhance the war effort itself. And the Four Freedoms paintings, each one of which were sort of put into visual terms that Americans could immediately embrace, each of those Four Freedoms. And they went to about 15 cities around the United States, all the way from the Northeast, to the Northwest, to the Southwest, to the South. And people just turned out probably in the millions. I don't have the exact figure, but celebrities turned out at every one of the venues. I mean, it was a really major, major series of events and fundraising activities. So this is the 75th anniversary. And a few years ago, the proposal was made to put the paintings back on the road, not just by themselves, but to have a whole exhibit on the Four Freedoms, and not to exclude the ways in which the Four Freedoms were, if you like, failing to address all Americans' needs. So it does refer, this exhibit that's going on the road, to the things I referred to before, such as the Japanese-American internment. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to be a major exhibit that opens on, May 25th. Just, 9 days away in New York City at the New York Historical Society. I urge people, if they live in the New York area, to go over to Central Park West Side and take in the exhibit. From there, it's going to go to Detroit, to Dearborn, to the Henry Ford Museum. I won't go into the irony of Henry Ford Museum being the host of that. Mm-hmm. And eventually it'll go to such places as Houston and to Washington, D.C. I'm forgetting some place, I apologize. And it'll also go over to Normandy in France. So it's going to get around the country and then head overseas for a bit.
This is going to go through 2020. Years. Yeah.
Yeah, all the way through 2020. Yeah. Which then also sort of, and all of this has been, I've been the historical advisor on a committee made up of some of the nation's best artists and illustrators. So I've learned a lot, and I hope I've contributed something to it as well.
That is cool. And in addition to that, you're I don't know if it's your TV debut, but maybe as a host of a movie night on Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, right. I mean, I've done a number of TV programs, from C-SPAN to Bill Moyers a few times. I've been on MSNBC, but I've never done anything like this before. So, Ben Mankiewicz, the host of Turner Classic Movies, he and I became acquainted about a year and a half ago when he wanted to interview me for the Young Turks Network. And we did a 1-hour interview on the Four Freedoms. And he and I became friendly as we discovered both our fathers fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He himself comes from a legendary Hollywood family, but also a major Democratic Party family. When you think of Frank Mankiewicz having been the campaign manager for Bobby Kennedy in 1968. And I don't think I'm giving anything away that he was progressive enough, Frank Mankiewicz, that when Jimmy Carter in 76 asked him if he would run his campaign, Frank Mankiewicz said to him, "Tell me why you want to run for president. Every journalist is going to ask you that." And Carter's reply was, "I want to make government more efficient." And Frank Mankiewicz said, then you've got the wrong guy to run your campaign." So Ben picked up on the progressivism of his father. Anyhow, so we did the interview, and as we talked about this, I said to him, "Hey, I've got this idea," though I wasn't officially allowed to ask the question, but it worked out well in the end. I said, "Maybe we can get the Norman Rockwell Museum and the project that I'm involved in and teamed up with Turner Classic Movies. Maybe we can do a sort of television launch, or at least a movie launch, of the Four Freedoms tour." And fortunately, the people at Turner Classic Movies really liked the idea. So it's just about a year ago when I was working in tandem with the program coordinator at TCM. And he said to me, "You know what? You choose the films that we'll broadcast." And I thought, oh my God, you know, I mean, I'm not a film aficionado, but I spent the summer sort of, you know, getting DVDs and watching Turner Classic Movies to see if I could catch some ideas. So I came up with actually 5 films, 3 major films and 2 shorts. And can I mention that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So each one of these, there's nothing specific. None of these films are made specifically to address one of the freedoms. They all address a few of the freedoms. But let me say that the first film that I selected actually predates Roosevelt's speech, on the fight for the Four Freedoms. It's the movie Grapes of Wrath, of course, based on the Steinbeck novel and starring Henry Fonda and a really remarkable cast. And it's just an absolutely fabulous film. And it really, as people may not, well, maybe people don't know, it addresses the plight of what are called the Okies, the Oklahoma farmers, who basically were driven off their lands by a combination of the Dust Bowl and also the failure at the time of Americans to know how to address the Dust Bowl. So there was this massive migration, just as there had been a great migration of African Americans to the north during the teens, the 20s, and into the 30s. You had a mass migration of Oklahomans, rural Oklahomans, out to California in the 1930s. And by the way, as I said before, agricultural workers did not have the right. They had the right to try to organize, but these California growers that they went to work for were really SOBs. I mean, they're really bastards. And they used every device to take every advantage of these folks and to make sure that union efforts were beaten back with clubs and guns if necessary. But so this is the story of one family, the Jodes, and their struggle in Oklahoma. But it also shows, because Steinbeck was very much a supporter of the New Deal, it also shows the degree to which the New Deal found its way into California and even into rural California by way of these particular camps where people were welcomed and safe and secure. So it's just a great film, and I urge people, if they can catch it, to do so if they haven't already seen it. And that, in many ways, is the film that speaks to both freedom from want and freedom from fear. But I also think it speaks to freedom of expression because of the degree to which these California growers are willing to beat the shit out of workers trying to organize.
Hmm.
The second film is one that I actually think in some ways may be the best film ever made, and that's Casablanca.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman and Paul Henreid and the guy who plays the French police commissioner. Oh, Crane, not Crane. It's just a fabulous, fabulous movie. And I like all of the actors in it. And the performances are great. And it's a love story and a political story. And as people may not realize, Casablanca refers to the fact that during the first period of the war, after France itself was defeated, refugees from Europe, if they had any means to make it at all, were heading into North Africa to get to Casablanca in hopes of getting to Lisbon and then on to maybe London or even to the United States seeking refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just absolutely wonderful kind of film. And if people see it, they'll immediately recognize lines in it. I mean, it's the kind of thing that, it's just great. And that film really gets at, in a certain fashion, though people don't think about it until I mention it quite often, freedom of worship. Because
sure.
Most of the actors in the movie were actually themselves refugees from Hitler's Germany. So
wow.
That adds a kind of a new dimension to the film for people who watch it. And moreover, Humphrey Bogart's character, a lot of people don't pay enough attention, was himself a veteran of the Spanish Civil War. You know, the leftists who went to fight in defense of Republican Democratic Spain against the fascists led by Franco. So it's this really great movie having to do with freedom of worship. And of course, it really is about Americans and how they were not eager to go to war. But when cornered, well, we know what happens. We end up pursuing the greatest war effort in American history. The third film is actually two shorts that I selected. One, which won an Academy Award in 1945, is titled The House I Live In, which stars Frank Sinatra. And that one really has to do with freedom of worship. It's about these kids who are about to beat the shit out of a young Jewish kid. And Frank Sinatra, who plays himself, steps out into the alley taking a break from a recording session and basically ends up breaking up this possible fight. And talks to these kids about what America means to him, and he does it in the form of this song, The House I Live In, which was a song written by two communist songwriters, actually, during the 1940s. The song, as Sinatra performs it, was censored a bit, but nevertheless remains a very moving kind of tune. And then also something called The Cummington Story, which is about refugees coming to America. And I'll leave it to people if they can catch it to watch it. The reason I first discovered The Cummington Story had to do with the fact that I was really interested in Aaron Copland, the greatest American composer ever.
Right.
And I found out that Copland wrote the music to this little 20-minute film done by the U.S. government during the war as a sort of message to what refugees might need at war's end. Last film.
Wow, that might be pertinent for today, too, huh?
Well, by the way, one of the reasons I chose it was exactly for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I should come back and talk about the relevance of the Four Freedoms to today all the more next time I come on.
Sure.
But what I was going to say is the last film is just, it may well be one of Bogart's best performances, and no one seems to know of this film. It's titled Deadline USA. Have you ever seen this film?
Never heard of it.
Oh, it's just fabulous. If you can DVR, I don't know if you have TCM on whatever system you mm-hmm. have for television, but see if you can DVR it. So Humphrey Bogart's 1952. So this is set during the McCarthy years. Let's keep that in mind. And he's the editor of a big city newspaper, maybe a paper like the New York Times. And he's under pressure as the editor from two external forces, one of which is capitalism, and the other one is the mob. And I can tell you, it has to do, it's a very prophetic film, and the ways in which sort of greed is putting pressure on the newspaper, and in fact may literally shut the paper down. But on the other hand, it's also about, I think, McCarthyism, because the mobster side of this story, if you watch this movie, the man who's the mobster, and they're pursuing an investigation of this guy, the newspaper, to see to what extent he's been buying and selling politicians and maybe even committing murder in the process. You look at the guy, an actor named Martin Gable, who was just a great actor in his day, and they make him out to look exactly like Joe McCarthy. So it's as if in the midst of the McCarthy era, the mob is presented in a way that if you look at it, you can see it may well be McCarthyism and its threat to freedom of speech. So I would urge people to DVR, because it's going to be like 8 o'clock in the East. It starts next Monday night, and it'll probably go to like 1:30 in the morning when you include intros and outros, as right. They call them in movies. But each film is really, really worth seeing. And I'd like to imagine what I have to say is worth listening to. So there
right,
you
so,
go.
So this will be Monday, the 21st of May, starting at 8 Eastern, and running until the five films end.
Right.
How exciting.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. I really couldn't believe I was doing it in some ways. I've always been fascinated. Well, I always love talking to you, and I love radio, and I just adore radio, and I adore online radio all the more because it's our basically our service, you might say. Mm-hmm. Forgetting the fascists who also get on the online. Yeah. We don't want to talk about them.
No.
But it's the case that to get onto TCM with Ben, I thought, wow, this is, you know, I was almost pinching myself thinking, man, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
You know, so, And what's funny, I mean, I don't know how many people have ever seen me on TV or seen pictures of me anywhere, but I kind of branded myself at some point. So I wear my navy blue turtleneck and my navy blue blazer and my jeans. And you know, even they said, sure, if you want to do that, go right ahead. So
cool. Well,
yeah,
well, this
fun.
Will be exciting. So it's May 21st, the Four Freedoms, which, again, it goes back to your book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. I do want to go back to, because you had mentioned FDR's second Bill of Rights, and I've got a little excerpt.
That's a good point to close on. Yeah.
I've got a little excerpt of his speech that I want to play.
Great.
So
great.
In his own words, here you go.
In our day, certain economic proofs have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom, freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. The right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
Such ideals back then.
Right, right. Now, please note, if the Democrats ever get their act together, that probably two of the key elements in that second Bill of Rights, that economic Bill of Rights, should be high on their agenda. The first is the right to a job. Maybe we can get back to the real meaning of right to work. Mm-hmm. That is the right to a job. And I think the question of full employment made it onto the public agenda in a big way in 1945 and 46, but the Republicans pretty essentially suppressed that right along with the Southern Democrats as time went by. And of course, the other one is national health care. I'm not giving up on that.
No, nor am I, especially as the Republicans are trying to take it away from us yet again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
It's remarkable. Harvey J.K., are you working on another book?
I am, although I'm going to confess to everyone that I'm working on a book titled The Radicals at Heart, Why We Need to Embrace Our Radical History. But I literally took such an intellectual and emotional beating during this past year that I've been stymied, and suffering writer's block, trying to come to grips with the nightmare of Trump and the fact that that basically half of the American people were willing to vote for that.
Yeah, you're not the only one. It's taken a beating on a lot of us. Oh, well. Well, we'll wait. We'll be patient.
Thank you. We'll watch you on
May 21st on Turner Classic Movies. Harvey J.K., thank you so much.
Okay. Talk to you again soon, I hope. Bye-bye.